This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Target, written by David Baldacci, read by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy. Chapter 1. 400 men lived here, most for the rest of their time on Earth, and then hell would get them for the rest of eternity. The walls were thick concrete, and their interior sides were layered with repulsive graffiti that spared virtually nothing in its collective depravity. And each year more filth was grafted onto the walls like sludge building up in a sewer. The steel bars were nicked and scarred, but still impossible to break by human hands. There had been escapes from here, but none for more than 30 years. Once outside the walls, there was no place to go. The people living on the outside around here weren't any friendlier than the ones on the inside. And they actually had more guns. The old man had another severe coughing fit and spit up blood, which was as much evidence of his terminal condition as any expert medical pronouncement. He knew he was dying. The only question was when. He had to hang on, though. He had something left to do, and he would not get a second chance to do it. Earl Fontaine was large, but had once been larger still. His body had imploded as the metastatic cancer ate him from the inside out. His face was heavily wrinkled, savaged by time. 4 packs of menthols a day, a poor diet, and most of all, a bitter sense of injustice. His skin was thin and pasty from decades inside this place, where the sun did not reach. With a struggle, he sat up in his bed and looked around at the other occupants of the ward. There were only 7 of them, none as bad off as he was. They might leave this place upright. He was beyond that. Yet despite his dire condition, he smiled. Another inmate from across the floor saw Earl's happy expression and called out, "What in the hell do you have to smile about, Earl? Let us in on the joke, why don't you?" Earl let the grin ease all the way across his broad face. He managed to do so despite the pain in his bones that was akin to someone cutting through them with a brittle bladed saw.
"Getting out of here, Junior," Earl said.
"Bullshit,"
said the other inmate, who was known as Junior inside these walls for no apparent reason. He had raped and killed 5 women across 3 counties simply because they had been unfortunate enough to cross his path. The authorities were working like mad to treat his current illness so he could keep his official execution date in 2 months. Earl nodded.
"Out of here." "How?" "Coughing is how, Junior, just like your scrawny ass."
Earl cackled, while Junior shook his head and turned back to stare glumly at his IV lines. They were similar to the ones that would carry the lethal chemicals that would end his life in Alabama's death chamber. He finally looked away, closed his eyes, and went swiftly to sleep as though practicing for the deepest of all slumbers in exactly 60 days. Earl lay back and rattled the chain attached to the cuff around his right wrist, which in turn was hooked to a stout though rusted iron ring set into the wall.
"I'm getting away," he bellowed. "Better send the coon dogs come get me."
Then he went into another coughing spell that lasted until a nurse came over and gave him some water, a pill, and a hard slap on the back. Then he helped Earl sit up straighter. The nurse probably didn't know why Earl had been sent to prison and probably wouldn't have cared if he did know. Every inmate in this Max prison had done something so appallingly horrific that every guard and worker here was completely desensitized to it. "Now, just settle down, Earl," said the nurse. "It'll only make things worse." Earl calmed, sat back against his pillow, and then eyed the nurse steadily.
"Can they be? Worse is what I mean."
The nurse shrugged.
"Guess anything can be worse, and maybe you should have thought of that before you got to this place."
With a burst of energy, Earl said,
Hey, kid, can you get me a smoke?
Just slip it twixt my fingers and light me up. Won't tell nobody you done it. Cross and swear and all that crap, though, I ain't no God-fearing man.
The nurse blanched at the very idea of doing such a thing.
Yeah, maybe if it were 1970.
You're hooked up to oxygen, for God's sake. It's explosive, Earl, as in boom.
Earl grinned, revealing discolored teeth and many gaps in between.
Yeah, I'll take blowing up over being eaten alive from this crap inside me.
Yeah, but the rest of us wouldn't. See, that's most people's problem, only thinking of themselves.
Just one cig, kid. I like the Winstons. You got Winstons? It's my dying wish. Got to abide by it like my last supper. It's the damn law.
He rattled his chain.
Last smoke. Gotta gimme it.
He rattled his chain louder.
Gimme it.
The nurse said, You're dying of lung cancer, Earl. Now, how do you think you got that? Here's a clue. They call them cancer sticks for a damn good reason. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. With that kind of stupidity, you can thank the good Lord you live long as you have.
Gimme the smoke, you little prick.
The nurse was obviously done dealing with Earl. Look, I got a lot of patients to take care of. Let's have a quiet day. What do you say, old man? I don't want to have to call a guard. Albert's on ward duty now, and Albert is not known for his TLC. He'll put a baton to your skull, sick and dying or not, and then lie in his report, and not one person will dispute it. Dude's scary, and he don't give a shit. You know that. Before the nurse turned away, Earl said,
You know why I'm here?
The nurse smirked. Let's see. 'Cause you're dying, and the state of Alabama won't release someone like you to secure hospice, even if you are costing them a ton of money in medical bills?
No, not this here hospital ward. I'm talking prison, said Earl, his voice low and throaty. Give me some more water, will you? I can get me water in this goddamn place, can't I?
The nurse poured a cup and Earl greedily drank it down, wiped his face dry, and said with pent-up energy,
Got behind bars over 20 years ago. First just for life in a federal cage, but then they got me on the death penalty thing. Sons of bitches, lawyers. And the state done took a hold of my ass. Feds let 'em, just let 'em. I got rights. Hell, I got nothing if they can do that. See what I'm saying? Just 'cause I killed her, had a nice bed in a fed place. Now look at me. Bet I got me the cancer 'cause of this here place. No, I did. In the air. Lucky for me, I never got that AIDS shit.
He raised his eyebrows and lowered his voice.
You know they got that kind in here.
Uh-huh, said the nurse, who was checking the file of another patient on his laptop. It was set on a rolling cart that had locked compartments where meds were kept.
Earl said,
That's 2 decades plus almost 2 years now. Long damn time.
Yep. You know your math all right, Earl, the nurse said absently.
The first Bush was still president, but that boy from Arkansas done beat him in the election. We saw it on the TV when I got here. Yeah, it was 1992. What was his name again? They say he's part colored.
Bill Clinton. And he's not part black. He just played the saxophone and went to the African-American churches sometimes.
That's right, him. Been here since then.
I was 7.
What?
Barked Earl, squinting his eyes to see better. He rubbed absently at the pain in his belly. The nurse said, I was 7 when Clinton was elected. My mama and daddy were conflicted. They were Republicans, of course, but he was a Southern boy, all right. I think they voted for him, but wouldn't admit to it. Didn't matter none. This is Alabama, after all. A liberal wins here, hell freezes over, am I right?
Sweet home, Alabama, said Earl, nodding. Lived here a long time.
Had a family here. But I'm from Georgia, son. I'm a Georgia peach, see? Not no Alabama boy.
Okay.
And I got sent to this here prison 'cause of what I'd done in Alabama.
Sure you did. Not that much difference, though. Georgia, Alabama, kissing cousins. Not like they were taking your ass up to New York or Massachusetts. Foreign countries up there for shit sure.
'Cause of what I'd done,
said Earl breathlessly, still rubbing at his belly.
Can't stand Jews, coloreds, and Catholics. Don't much care for Presbyterians, neither.
The nurse looked at him and said in an amused tone, Presbyterians? What the hell they ever done to you, Earl? That's like hating the Amish.
Squeal like hogs getting butchered, swear to God they did. Jews and coloreds, mostly.
He shrugged and absently wiped sweat from his brow using his sheet.
Hell, truth is, I never kill me no Presbyterian. They just don't stand out, see? But I woulda, if I got the chance.
His smile deepened, reaching all the way to his eyes. And in that look, it was easy to see that despite age and illness, Earl Fontaine was a killer, was still a killer, would always be a killer until the day he died, which couldn't come soon enough for lawful-minded citizens. The nurse unlocked a drawer on his cart and took out some meds. Now, why'd you want to go and do something like that? Them folks done nothing to you, I bet. Earl coughed up some phlegm and spit it into his cup. He said grimly,
They was breathing. That was good enough for me.
Guess that's why you're in here, all right. But you gotta set it right with God, Earl. They're all God's children. Gotta set it right. You'll be seeing him soon. Earl laughed till he choked. Then he calmed, and his features seemed to clear.
I got people coming to see me.
That's nice, Earl, said the nurse, as he administered a painkiller to the inmate in the next bed. Family?
No, I done kill my family.
Why'd you do that? Were they Jews? Or Presbyterians? Or coloreds?
Folks coming to see me, said Earl. I ain't done yet, see?
Uh-huh. The nurse checked the monitor of the other inmate. Good to make use of any time you got left, old man. Clock, she is a ticking, all right. For all of us.
Coming to see me today, said Earl. Marked it on the wall here, look.
He pointed to the concrete wall where he had used his fingernail to chip off the paint.
They said 6 days and they'd be coming to see me. Got me 6 marks on there. Good with numbers. Mine's still working and all.
Well, you sure tell him hello from me, said the nurse, as he moved away with his cart. Later, Earl stared at the doorway to the ward where 2 men had appeared. They were dressed in dark suits and white shirts, and their black shoes were polished. One wore black-framed glasses. The other looked like he'd barely graduated from high school. They were both holding Bibles and sporting gentle, reverential expressions. They appeared respectable, peaceful, and law-abiding. They were actually none of those things. Earl caught their eye.
Coming to see me, he mumbled.
His senses suddenly as clear as they had ever been. Once more he had a purpose in life. It would be right before he died, but it was still a purpose.
Kill my family, he said.
But that wasn't entirely accurate. He had murdered his wife and buried her body in the basement of their home. They hadn't found it until years later. That was why he was here and had been sentenced to death. He could have found a better hiding place, he supposed, but it had not been a priority. He was busy killing others. The federal government had let the state of Alabama try, convict, and sentence him to death for her murder. He had had a scheduled visit to Alabama's death chamber at the Holman Correctional Facility near Atmore.
Since 2002, the state of Alabama officially killed you by lethal injection. But some death penalty proponents were advocating the return of Old Sparky to administer final justice by electrocution to those on death row. None of that troubled Earl. His appeal had carried on for so long that he'd never be executed now. It was because of his cancer. Ironically enough, the law said an inmate had to be in good health in order to be put to death. Yet they'd only saved him from a quick, painless demise so that nature could substitute a longer, far more painful one in the form of lung cancer that had spread all over him. Some would call that sweet justice. He just called it shitty luck. He waved over the two men in suits. He had killed his wife, to be sure, and he'd killed many others, exactly how many he didn't remember. Jews, coloreds, maybe some Catholics, he wasn't sure. Maybe he'd killed a Presbyterian, too. Hell, he didn't know. Wasn't like they carried ID proclaiming their faith. Anybody who got in his way was someone who needed killing, and he had allowed as many people to get in his way as was humanly possible. Now he was chained to a wall and was dying, but still, he had something left to do. More precisely, he had one more person to kill. Chapter 2. The men could not have looked any more tense. It was as though the weight of the world was resting on each of their shoulders. Actually, it was. The President of the United States sat in the seat at the end of the small table. They were in the Situation Room complex in the basement of the West Wing of the White House, sometimes referred to as the Woodshed. The complex was first built during President Kennedy's term after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Kennedy no longer thought he could trust the military and wanted his own intelligence overseers who would parse the reports coming in from the Pentagon. The Truman Bowling Alley had been sacrificed to build the complex, which had later undergone major renovations in 2006. During Kennedy's era, a single analyst from the CIA would man the Situation Room in an unbroken 20-hour shift, sleeping there as well. Later, the place had been expanded to include the Department of Homeland Security and the White House Chief of Staff's office. However, the National Security Council staff ran the complex. 5 watch teams, comprised of 30 or so carefully vetted personnel, operated the Situation Room on a 24/7 basis. Its primary goal was to keep the president and his senior staff briefed each day on important issues, and allow for instant and secure communications anywhere in the world. It even had a secure link to Air Force One, in the event the president was traveling. The Situation Room itself was large, with space for 30 or more participants and a large video screen on the wall. Mahogany had been the wood surface of choice before the renovation. Now the walls were composed mainly of whisper materials that protected against electronic surveillance. But tonight the men were not in the main conference room, nor were they in the president's briefing room. They were in a small conference room that had 2 video screens on the wall and a row of world-time clocks above. There were chairs for 6 people. Only 3 of them were occupied. The president's seat allowed him to stare directly at the video screens. To his right was Josh Potter, the National Security Advisor. To his left was Evan Tucker, head of the CIA. That was all. The circle of need to know was minuscule, but there would be a 4th person joining them in a moment by secure video link. The staff normally in the Situation Room had been walled off from this meeting and the coming communication. There was only 1 person handling the transmission, and even that person would not be privy to what was said. The VP would normally have been part of such a meeting. However, if what they were planning went awry, he might be taking over the top spot because the president could very well be impeached. Thus, they had to keep him out of the loop. It would be terrible for the country if the president had to leave office. It would be catastrophic if the VP were forced out too. The Constitution dictated that the top spot would then go to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and no one wanted the head of what could very well be the most dysfunctional group in Washington to be suddenly running the country. The president cleared his throat and said,
"This could be momentous, or it could be Armageddon."
Potter nodded, as did Tucker. The president looked at the CIA chief.
"This is rock solid, Evan?"
"Rock solid, sir. In fact, not to toot our own horn, but this is the price for nearly 3 years of intelligence work performed under the most difficult conditions imaginable. It has, frankly, never been done before." The president nodded and looked at the clocks above the screens. He checked his own watch against them and made a small adjustment to his timepiece. It looked as though he had aged 5 years in the last 5 minutes. All American presidents had to make decisions that could shake the world. In numerous ways, the demands of the position were simply beyond the ability of a mere mortal to carry out. But the Constitution required that the position be held by only one person. He let out a long breath and said,
"This had better work."
Potter said, "Agreed, sir."
"It will work," insisted Tucker.
"And the world will be much better off for it," he added.
"I have a professional bucket list, sir, and this is number two on it, right behind Iran. And in some ways, it should be number one."
Potter said, "Because of the nukes."
"Of course," said Tucker. "Iran wants nukes. These assholes already have them. With delivery capabilities that are inching closer and closer to our mainland. Now, if we pull this off, believe me, Tehran will sit up and take notice. Maybe we kill two birds with one stone."
The president put up a hand.
"I know the story, Evan. I've read all the briefings. I know what hangs in the balance."
The screen flickered and a voice came over the speaker system embedded in the wall.
"Mr. President, the transmission is ready."
The president unscrewed the top of a water bottle sitting in front of him and took a long drink. He put the bottle back down.
"Do it," he said curtly.
The screen flickered once more and then came fully to life. It was staring at a man short in stature, in his 70s, with a deeply lined and tanned face. There was a rim of white near his hairline, where the cap he normally wore helped to block the sun. But he was not in uniform now. He was dressed in a gray tunic with a high, stiff collar. He stared directly at them. Evan Tucker said,
"Thank you for agreeing to communicate with us tonight, General Pack."
Pack nodded and said, in halting but clearly enunciated English,
"It is good to meet face to face, as it were."
He smiled, showing off highly polished veneers. The president attempted to smile back, but his heart was not in it. He knew that Pack would lose his life if exposed, but the president had a lot to lose, too.
"We appreciate the level of cooperation received," he said.
Pack nodded.
"Our goals are the same, Mr. President. For too long we have been isolated. It is time for us to take our seat at the world's table. We owe it to our people."
Tucker said encouragingly,
"We completely agree with that assessment, General Pack."
"Details are progressing nicely," said Pack. "Then you can commence your part in this. You must send your best operatives. Even with my help, the target is a very difficult one."
Pack held up a single finger.
"This will be the number of opportunities we will have. No more, no less."
The president glanced at Tucker and then back at Pack.
"We would send nothing less than our very best for something of this magnitude."
Potter said,
"And we are sure of both the intelligence and the support?"
Pack nodded.
"Absolutely sure. We have shared that with your people, and they have confirmed the same."
Potter glanced at Tucker, who nodded.
"If it is discovered," said Pack, They all became riveted to him.
If it becomes discovered, I will surely lose my life, and America, your loss will be far greater.
He looked the president directly in the eye and took a few moments seemingly to compose his words carefully.
It is why I asked for this video conference, Mr. President. I will be sacrificing not only my life, but the lives of my family as well. That is the way here, you see. So I need your complete and absolute assurance that if we move forward, we do so together and united, no matter what might happen. You must look me in the eye and tell me this is so.
The blood seemed to drain from the face of the president. He had made many important decisions during his term, but none so stressful or potentially momentous as this one. He didn't look at either Potter or Tucker before answering. He kept his gaze right on Pack.
You have my word, he said in a strong, clear voice.
Pack smiled, showing off the perfect teeth again.
That is what I needed to hear.
Together, then, he saluted the president, who gave his own crisp salute in return. Tucker hit a button on the console in front of him, and the screen went black once more. The president let out an audible breath and sat back against the leather of his chair. He was sweating, though the room was cool. He wiped a drop of moisture off his forehead. What they were proposing to do was quite clearly illegal, an impeachable offense. And unlike the other presidents impeached before him, he had no doubt the Senate would convict him.
Into the breach rode the 500, the president said in barely a whisper.
But both Potter and Tucker heard it and nodded in agreement. The president leaned forward and looked squarely at Tucker.
There is no margin for error, none. And if there is the least hint of this coming out,
sir, that will not happen. This is the first time we've ever had an asset placed that high over there.
There was an attempt on the leadership last year, as you know, while he was traveling on the street in the Capitol, but it was botched. That was from low-level internal sources and had nothing to do with us. Our strike will be quick and clean, and it will succeed.
And you have your team in place.
Being assembled, and then they'll be vetted.
The president looked sharply at him.
Vetted? Who the hell are you planning to use?
Will Roby and Jessica Reel.
Potter sputtered.
Roby and Reel?
They are the absolute best we have, said Tucker. Look what they did with Ahmadi in Syria.
Potter eyed Tucker closely. He knew every detail of that mission. Thus he knew that neither Reel nor Roby had been intended to survive it. The president said slowly,
"But with Reel's background, what you allege she did, the possibility of her going..."
Tucker broke in. Normally this would be unheard of. You let the president speak. But tonight Evan Tucker seemed to see and hear only what he wanted to.
"They are the best, sir, and the best is what we need here. As I said, with your permission, they will be vetted to ensure that their performance will be at the highest level. However, if they fail the vetting, I have another team, nearly as good, and certainly up to the task of performing the mission. But the clear preference is not the B team.
Potter said,
"But why not simply deploy the backup team? Then this vetting process becomes unnecessary."
Tucker looked at the president.
"We really need to do it this way, sir, for a number of reasons. Reasons which I'm sure you can readily see."
Tucker had prepared for this exact moment for weeks. He had studied the president's history, his time as commander-in-chief, and even gotten his hands on an old psychological profile of the man done while he was running for Congress many years ago. The president was smart and accomplished, but not that smart, and not that accomplished. That meant he had a chip on his shoulder. Thus he was reluctant to acknowledge that he was not always the smartest, most informed person in the room. Some would see that attribute as a strength.
Tucker knew it to be a serious vulnerability, ripe for exploitation. And he was exploiting it right now. The president nodded.
Yes. Yes, I can see that.
Tucker's face remained impassive, but inwardly he breathed a sigh of relief. The president leaned forward.
I respect Roby and Real. But again, there is no margin for error here, Evan. So you vet the hell out of them, and make damn sure they are absolutely ready for this. Or you use the B-team. Are we clear?
Crystal, said Tucker. Chapter 3 Will Roby, unable to sleep, stared at the ceiling of his bedroom while the rain pounded away outside. His head was pounding even more, and it would not stop when the rain did. He finally rose, dressed, put on a long slicker with a hood, and set out from his apartment in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. He walked for nearly an hour through the darkness. There were few people about at this hour of the morning. Unlike other major cities, D.C. did sleep, at least the part you could see. The government side, the one that existed underground and behind concrete bunkers, and in innocuous-looking low-rise buildings, never slumbered. Those people were going as hard right now as they would during the daylight hours. Three men in their early 20s approached from the other side of the street. Roby had already seen them, sized them up, and knew what they would demand of him. There were no cops around, no witnesses. He did not have time for this. He did not have the desire for this. He turned and walked directly at them. "If I give you some money, will you leave?" he asked the tallest of the three. This one was his size, a six-footer packing about 180 street-hardened pounds. The man drew back his windbreaker, revealing a black Sig 9 mil in the waistband that hung low over his hips.
"Depends on how much."
"100? The man looked at his two comrades.
"Make it a deuce and you're on your way, dude."
"I don't have a deuce."
"So you say. Then you gonna get jacked right here."
He went to draw the gun, but Roby had already taken it from his waistband and pulled down his pants at the same time. The man tripped over his fallen trousers. The man on the right pulled a knife and then watched in amazement as Roby first disarmed him and then laid him out with three quick punches, two to the right kidney, one to the jaw. Roby added a kick to the head after the man smacked the pavement. The third man did not move. The tall man exclaimed,
"Shit, you a ninja?"
Roby glanced down at the SIG he held. "It's not balanced properly and it's rusted. You need to take care of your weapons better, or they won't perform when you want them to." He flicked the weapon over them. "How many more guns?" The third man's hand went to his pocket. "Drop the jacket," ordered Roby.
"It's raining and cold," the man protested.
Roby put the SIG's muzzle directly against his forehead. "Not asking again." The jacket came off and fell into a puddle. Roby picked it up. Found the Glock. "I see the throwaways at your ankles," he said. "Out." The throwaways were handed over. Roby balled them all up in the jacket. He eyed the tall man. "See where greed gets you? Should have taken the Benny."
"We need our guns."
"I need them more." Roby kicked some water from the puddle into the unconscious man's face, and he awoke with a start, then rose on shaky legs. He did not seem to know what was going on and probably had a concussion. Roby flicked the gun again. "Down that way, all of you. Turn right into the alley." The tall man suddenly looked nervous.
"Hey, dude, look, we're sorry, okay? But this is our turf here. We patrol it. It's our livelihood."
"You want a livelihood? Get a real job that doesn't involve putting a gun in people's faces and taking what doesn't belong to you. Now walk. Not asking again." They turned and marched down the street. When one of the men turned to look back,
Roby clipped him in the head with the butt of the SIG. Eyes straight. Turn around again, you get a third one, to look through in the back of your head. Roby could hear each of the men's breathing accelerate. Their legs were jelly. They believed they were walking to their execution. "Walk faster," barked Roby. They picked up their pace. "Faster, but don't run." The three men looked idiotic, trying to go faster while still walking. "Now, run!" The three men broke into a sprint. They turned left at the next intersection and were gone. Roby turned and headed in the opposite direction. He ducked down an alley, found a dumpster, and heaved the jacket and guns into it after clearing out all of the ammo. He dropped the bullets down a sewer grate. He did not get many opportunities for peaceful moments, and he did not like it when they were interrupted. Roby continued his walk and reached the Potomac River. This had not been an idle sojourn. He had come here with a purpose. He drew the object from the pocket of his slicker and looked down at it, running his finger along the polished surface. It was a medal, the highest award that the Central Intelligence Agency gave out for heroism in the field. Roby had earned it, together with another agent, for a mission undertaken in Syria at great personal risk. They had barely made it back alive. In fact, it was the wish of certain people at the agency that they not make it back alive. One of those persons was Evan Tucker, and it was unlikely he was going away because he happened to head up the CIA. The other agent who had received the award was Jessica Reel. She was the real reason Evan Tucker had not wanted them back alive. Reel had killed members of her own agency. It had been for a very good reason, but some people didn't care about that. Certainly Evan Tucker hadn't. Roby wondered where Reel was right now. They had parted on shaky ground. Roby had given her what he had believed was his unconditional support. Yet Reel did not seem to be capable of acknowledging such a gesture. Hence, the shaky parting. He gripped the chain like a slingshot and whirled the metal around and around. He eyed the dark surface of the Potomac. It was windy. There were a few small whitecaps. He wondered how far he could hurl the highest medal of the CIA into the depths of the river that formed one boundary of the nation's capital, separating it from the Commonwealth of Virginia. The chain twirled several times in the air. But in the end, Roby didn't fling it out into the river. He returned the medal to his pocket. He wasn't sure why. He had just started back when his phone buzzed. He took it out, glanced at the screen and grimaced. "Roby," he said tersely. It was a voice he didn't recognize. "Please hold for D.D. Amanda Marks." "Please hold? Since when does the world's most elite clandestine agency have its personnel say, 'Please hold'?"
"Roby?"
The voice was crisp, sharp as a new blade, and in its undertone, Roby could detect both immense confidence and a desire to prove oneself. That was a potentially deadly combination for him, because Roby would be the one doing this woman's bidding in the field while she safely watched from a computer screen thousands of miles away. "Yes?"
"We need you in here ASAP.
"You're the new DD?"
"That's what it says on my door."
"A mission?"
"We'll talk when you get in here. Langley,"
she added. Quite necessarily, because the CIA had numerous local facilities. "You know what happened to the last two DDs?" Roby asked.
"Just get your butt in here, Roby."
Chapter 4. Jessica Reel could not sleep either, and the weather was as bad on the eastern shore as it was in D.C. She stared at where her home had once been before it had been destroyed. She had actually done the deed herself. Well, she had booby-trapped the place, and Will Roby had triggered the explosion that had almost claimed his life. It was incredible how a partnership could have been born out of such grim circumstances. She pulled her hood tighter against the rain and wind and continued to tramp over the muddy earth,
while the waters of the Chesapeake Bay to the west continued to pound the little spit of land. She had departed from Roby feeling both hopeful and lost, such an unsettling feeling that she was unsure from which end to work through it, if there was even a way to do so. For most of her adult life, her work had been her entire world. Now, Real wasn't sure she really had a job or world left. Her agency despised her. Its leadership wanted her not merely out of the way, but dead. If she left her employment there, she felt she would be giving them license to terminate her in that far more permanent way. Yet if she stayed, what would her future be like? How long could she reasonably survive? What was her exit strategy? All troubling questions with no apparent answers. The last few months had cost her all she had, her three closest friends in the world, her reputation at the agency, perhaps her way of life. But she had gained something, or someone. Will Roby, initially her foe, had become her friend, her ally, the one person she could count on, when Real had never been able to do that easily or convincingly. But Roby knew her way of life as well as she did. Her way was his way. They would forever share that experience. He had offered her friendship, a shoulder to lean on, if it ever came to that. Yet part of her still wanted to withdraw from such an offer, to keep going it alone. She had not figured out her response to that or him yet. Maybe she would never have one. She looked up at the sky and let the pelting raindrops hit her in the face. She closed her eyes and a rush of images came to her. Each one a person and each one of them dead. Some were innocent, others not. Two had been killed by someone else. All the rest had died by her hand. One, her mentor and friend, lay in a vegetative state from which she would never awaken. It was all pointless, and it was all true. And Real was powerless to change any of it. She slipped the medal on its chain from her pocket and looked down at it. It was identical to the one Roby had been awarded. It had been given to her for the same mission. She had performed the kill shot, agency orders. Roby had helped her escape nearly certain death. They had made it back to the States to the chagrin of a powerful few. It was a meaningless gesture, this medal. What they really wanted to do was put a hole in her head. She walked to the edge of the land and watched the waters of the bay spray over the dirt. Real hurled the metal out into the bay as far as she could. She turned away before it struck the surface of the water. Metal didn't float. It would vanish in a few moments. But then she turned back around and used her middle finger to flip off the sinking metal, the CIA in general, and Evan Tucker specifically. That was the main reason she'd come, to chuck her medal into the bay. And this place had been her home, to the extent any place was. She did not intend to come back here. She had come to take one last look, perhaps to gain some closure. Yet she wasn't finding any. The next instant, she pulled her gun and ducked down low. Over the sounds of the water had come a new intrusion. A vehicle was pulling to a stop near the ruins of her waterside cottage. There was no reason for anyone to be visiting her here. The only reason anyone would appear here would be a violent one. She raced over to the only cover there was, a pile of rotted wood stacked near the water's edge. She knelt down and used the top log as a gun rest. While she could see nothing clearly, they might have night optics that would reveal all, including her location. She managed to follow them only by subtracting their darkened silhouettes from the darkness around them. She centered on one spot and waited for their movements to cross this point. By this method, she counted four of them. She assumed they were all armed, all calmed, and here for a specific purpose, her elimination. They would try to outflank her, but her rear was not capable of being flanked, unless they wanted to jump into the bay's cold and storm-tossed waters.
She focused on other spots and waited for them to cross. She did this again and again, until they were within 20 meters of her location. She wondered why they were staying packed together, separating during an attack with standard tactics. She could not follow so easily multiple groups coming at her from different places on the compass. But so long as they stayed together, her focus need not be diffused. She was deciding whether to fire or not when her phone buzzed. She was not inclined to answer, not with four bogeys bearing down her outgunned butt. But it might be Roby. As corny as it sounded, this might give her an opportunity to say goodbye in a way that was not possible before. And maybe he would go after her killers and slay them for her.
Yes,
she said into the phone, keeping her shooting hand on her Glock and her eyes on the forces coming for her. Please hold for D.D. Amanda Marks, said the efficient voice.
What the?
Began Real.
Agent Real, this is Amanda Marks, the new Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. We need you to come into Langley immediately. I'm a little busy right now, D.D. Marks,
replied Real sarcastically.
But maybe you're already aware of that,
she added in a harsh tone.
There are four agents currently at your cottage on the eastern shore, correction, where your cottage used to be. They are there simply to escort you to Langley. Please do not think of engaging with them and perhaps doing them harm. And are they planning to do me harm?
Snapped Real.
Because it's the middle of the night, I have no idea how they even knew I was here, and they're acting quite furtive. Your reputation precedes you, hence they are acting with care. As to your location, we determined you were nowhere else. And why do you need me to come in ASAP? That will all be explained when you get here. Is this about a new mission? When you get here, Agent Real, I can't trust that this line is secure. And if I choose not to come in? As I told Agent Roby. You called Roby in as well? Yes, he's all part of this, Agent Real. And you're really the new D.D.? Yes. Do you know what happened to the last two? The exact same question Agent Roby presented to me.
In spite of everything, Real smiled.
And your answer? The same as yours will be. Just get your butt in here.
The line went dead. Chapter 5. Hours later, Jessica Real arrived at Langley. The sun was up, the rain had passed, but her mood had not improved. She cleared security and entered a building she knew well, in some ways, too well. She was escorted to a room where she found a familiar face already waiting.
Roby,
she said curtly, before sitting down next to him. Jessica, said Roby, inclining his head slightly. I take it you received the same invitation.
It wasn't an invitation. It was an order. Did they send goons to bring you in?
He shook his head.
Then I guess they trust you more than they trust me. We trust you both the same,
said a voice as the door opened, and a woman in her early 40s with shoulder-length brown hair walked in carrying an electronic tablet. She was petite, about 5'4 and maybe 110 pounds, but lean and fit, and her wiry physique suggested a strength that belied her small size. D.D. Amanda Marks. She shook each of their hands while Roby and Real exchanged bemused looks.
Thank you both for coming in so promptly.
Real said,
if I knew I had a choice, I wouldn't have. The four guys you sent after me didn't provide any options. Nevertheless, your cooperation is appreciated,
said Marks in a brisk tone. Roby said, I thought after the last mission we had some stand-down time.
You did, and now that's over. So a new mission?
Real said wearily.
Not yet,
replied Marks.
First things first. Meaning what?
Asked Real.
Meaning that you both need to be what I would term recalibrated.
Roby and Real exchanged another glance. He said, you recalibrate instruments.
You are instruments of this agency. And we need recalibration why, exactly?
Asked Real. Marks had not made eye contact with them before, even when shaking their hands. She had either looked down or over their shoulders. It was disconcerting, but the tactic was not unexpected by either Roby or Real. Now Mark stared directly at them. And to Roby, she had the eyes of someone who had spent time behind a long-range scope at some point in her career.
"You really want to waste my time and yours, asking crap like that?"
she said in a low, even voice. Before either of them could respond, Mark said,
"You both went rogue on us."
She turned to look at Real.
"You killed one of our analysts and my predecessor."
She turned next to stare at Roby.
"And you aided and abetted her after being sent out to terminate her. In the aftermath of that situation, we had the decision to terminate or rehabilitate. The decision to rehabilitate was made. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I am here to implement it."
"I guess so much for our being awarded the CIA's highest honor," said Roby.
"Congratulations,"
said Marks.
"I have one in my closet, too, but that's history. I'm concerned only with the present and the future, yours. You've been given an unbelievable offer. There are some people here who desperately want you to screw up so other plans can be put into motion." "I can guess who one of them is,"
said Real.
"Your boss, Evan Tucker. And there are others here who hope you succeed and become productive members of this organization once more."
"And what camp are you in?" Roby asked.
"Neither. I'm Switzerland. I will lead your rehab, but the outcome is entirely up to both of you. I don't really care which way it goes, up, down, or sideways. It doesn't matter one iota to me."
Real nodded.
"Comforting. But you report directly to Evan Tucker. In a sense, everyone here reports directly to him. But I can assure you that you will have a full and fair opportunity to be rehabilitated. Whether you are or not is up to you."
Roby said, "And exactly whose idea was this? If it was Tucker's, I really can't see how the process will be fair in any way."
"Without going into details, I can tell you that a compromise was reached at the very highest level. You have powerful friends, Mr. Roby. You know exactly who I'm talking about. But there are also powerful forces aligned against both of you."
She looked at Real.
"Some who want nothing more than to see you executed for your past actions. If I'm not making myself crystal clear, please stop me."
Neither Roby nor Real spoke. She continued.
"Those forces collided, and the result was this compromise. Rehab, do or die. Up to you. Pretty generous, actually, in my humble opinion."
"I didn't think anyone trumped the president," said Roby.
"Politics is a dirty, ruthless business, Agent Roby. It makes the intelligence sector look relatively honorable by comparison. While it's true that the president is the 1,000-pound gorilla, there are lots of big beasts in this playground. And the president has an agenda and wants to further it, and that means he has to make concessions. In the grand scheme of things, you and Agent Real are not so important that you are above being traded as chips to further the man's agenda. Whether you got a medal or not, do you follow?"
"What precisely does rehab mean in this context?" asked Roby.
"We start from square one. You both have to be evaluated in every possible way, physically, psychologically, and intellectually. We're going to look pretty deeply into your heads. We're going to see whether you have what it takes to cut it in the field." "I thought we had proved that in Syria,"
interjected Real.
"Not part of the compromise. It was a one-off, and even then you didn't follow orders."
"Well, if we had followed orders, we'd both be dead," Roby pointed out.
"Again, not something I care about. It was the not following orders part that helped trigger what will happen now."
She turned on her electronic tablet and tapped the screen. Roby noted that her fingernails were cut below the tips of her fingers and had not a speck of color on them. The image of her as a sniper entered his mind once more. She looked up at him.
"You sustained serious burns to your leg and arm."
She glanced at Real.
"Her doing, not that anyone is keeping count. How are these injuries?"
"Coming along."
"Not good enough,"
said Marks.
"Now, you both jumped off a moving train. I'm sure that was fun." "More fun than the alternative,"
replied Real. Mark said,
"You lost friends during this past, adventure. I understand that you blame the agency for that." Well, their personnel were partially responsible. I'm not sure how else you can cut that. To have an effective rehab, you will have to get over that,
replied Mark sharply. She looked once more at Roby.
You were sent out to find Real. You did find her, but did not bring her in. You ended up joining forces with her against the agency's orders.
I went with my gut, and it turned out to be right.
Again, during rehab, you will have to decide where your ultimate loyalties lie, Roby. The next time, your gut may be wrong. And where does that leave you in the agency?
She did not wait for an answer, but continued.
The rehab will be very hard on all of us. I will be with you both every step of the way. You may quit the process at any time. And if we do?
Asked Real quickly.
Then all appropriate action will be taken against you. So I get habeas corpus and a fair trial?
Real said. Marks looked up.
I didn't say legal action, did I?
So it's do or die then? Said Roby.
You can label it however you wish, but ultimately the choice is completely up to you. So, what will it be?
Roby and Real exchanged another glance. Then Real nodded. Roby did the same.
Excellent choice,
said Marks.
Where is this rehab going to take place?
Asked Real.
Oh, I'm sorry, didn't I mention that? No, you didn't,
said Real tersely.
It will take place at a location I think you both know well.
She paused and took a moment to look at one and then the other.
The burner box,
she said with a slight smile.
We leave in 24 hours.
Chapter 6.
How long will you be gone?
Julie Getty asked. Roby looked down at his plate and didn't answer right away. They were at a hole-in-the-wall diner in D.C., not far from where 15-year-old Julie attended school. Roby had about 8 hours to go before he and Real would be headed to the burner box. Julie had been excited to hear from him. Her excitement had diminished when she learned it was to say goodbye, at least for a while. I'm not sure, said Roby, as he pushed his food around on his plate. It wasn't specified, he clarified.
And you can't tell me where you're going, of course,
she said resignedly. It's a training site.
Why do you need to train? You're already, great at what you do, Will.
It's like going back to school, you know, continuing education. Lots of professions do it. He hesitated. Even mine. She studied him critically, and he just as resolutely avoided her gaze.
Are you going alone on this?
She asked. He shook his head. No.
Is that woman going with you, Jessica?
Roby hesitated before answering. Yes.
So you're both in trouble.
Roby glanced sharply at her. She stared back at him with an expression that said his look of surprise was unnecessary.
I've spent a lot of time with you, Will. When people were trying to kill us, when you were moody, when you didn't have many options, but you still figured out how to get out of a jam.
And your point? He asked with genuine curiosity.
You look to me like a guy who doesn't see a way out of this, and that's just not you, so it must be really bad.
Roby said nothing while Julie fiddled with the straw in her drink. She said,
I read in the papers a while back that Farhad Ahmadi, the crazy Syrian trying to gain power over there, was gunned down. They never found who killed him.
Roby remained silent.
I'm not going to ask you if you and Jessica had something to do with that, because I know all I'll get is a blank stare. But if you did, then it seems that your mission was successful. So it has to be something else. Is it connected to Jessica?
Why do you ask that? Roby said abruptly.
Because things were going good for you at your agency, until she showed up.
I can't get into that with you, Julie.
Because, you see, I liked her. I think she's a good person.
I think so, too, said Roby, before he could catch himself. Julie smiled.
Cool.
What?
You're letting your guard down around me. And you must really care for her.
She added in a more serious tone. I can relate to her and what she's going through, Roby said diplomatically.
So she's your friend?
Yes.
You need to take care of your friends, Will.
I'm trying, Julie, I really am.
Are you ever going to be free of all this crap?
I wish I had the answer to that. After they left the restaurant and Roby dropped Julie off, his phone buzzed. It was real.
I think we need to talk.
Okay.
But you're being followed and I want some privacy.
Roby's gaze flicked to his rearview mirror. He noted the car on the street two back from his. Okay, let me see what I can do.
No need. I'll take care of it.
So you're back there too?
Did you really have to ask? How's Julie?
Concerned. Where do you want to meet?
In case someone is listening in, our place in the rain.
Roger that.
Take the next right. When you reach the alley, punch it.
Roby clicked off and sped up. He hung the right. The tail did the same. He saw the alley and floored it, creating separation from the tail. In the rear view, he watched as a semi pulled out of the alley, blocking the road. He heard brakes screech and a horn blaring. Nice, Jessica, he said to himself. He punched the gas, made a series of turns, and then glided onto Constitution and past the Washington Monument, no longer shrouded in scaffolding after the earthquake, and lit up like the Eiffel Tower. Some people thought they should have left it that way. 5 minutes and as many turns later, he pulled to the curb, put the car in park, cut the engine, and got out. He walked to the car parked in front of him and slid into the passenger seat. Jessica Reel started the car and sped off. Where to? He asked.
Nowhere. Just want to move while we talk.
Talk about what?
The burner box.
We've both been there, Jessica.
And you really want to go back?
I didn't think we had a choice.
You have a choice, Will. It's me they really want. I'll go. You don't have to.
I think it was a package deal. She pulled off the street, stopped the car, and slammed it into park.
Look, if you think you're doing me a favor by coming with me, you're not. It's just one more thing for me to worry about.
When did I say you ever had to worry about me?
You know what I'm talking about. It's better if I go it alone.
And what if they kill me for not going? How is that better for me?
I pulled the triggers on those two, Roby, not you. You can work a deal. Go to your people. They'll provide you cover. POTUS is on your side, for God's sake.
But what if I want to go to the burner box?
Why in the hell would you? And don't say for me, because that'll just piss me off even more.
Then I'm doing it for me.
You're making no sense now.
I want to know if I can still cut it, Jessica. The burner will tell me that.
The burner could end up killing you.
Well, if I can't cut it there, I sure as hell can't cut it in the field.
You heard Marks. She'll be gunning for both of us. It won't be a fair evaluation, despite what she said. Evan Tucker will have seen to that.
I don't really care.
Roby, how can you not care? You've only got one life.
Now you're the one not making sense. Every time I walk out the door, I'm risking my one life.
Evan Tucker went after us once and missed. This is his follow-up act. I doubt he'll make the same mistake. Unlike in Syria, he can control all aspects of the burner box and what goes on in there. Take it from me, an accident will happen that will tragically end our lives.
Well, if we're both there, he'll have to work twice as hard to nail us.
But he'll still nail us.
You need to be more optimistic.
And you need to get your head out of your ass.
I'm going, Jessica.
What about Julie? You're just going to walk out on her?
No. I'll do my best to get through this and see her again. But I have a job to do, and I'm good at it. And I'm going to keep doing it. And I'm going to have as normal a life as I possibly can while I'm doing it.
That's impossible, and you damn well know it.
He shook his head wearily. You really have to work on having a more positive attitude. And the only thing I know for certain is that I'm leaving on a trip tomorrow. So just drive me back to my car. I need to pack my bag and get some shut-eye. She dropped him back at his car. As he was getting out, she broke the silence.
You are the most exasperating.